It's time for the Phenology Show. Phenology is the rhythmic, biological nature of events as they relate to climate. I'm going to start off today with some notes about swamps, because I was in the swamps last Friday, and I couldn't have been happier. It was just lovely out there. If you would like to see a picture of me smiling from the swamps, go to the Minnesota Phenology Network Facebook page, and there's a portrait of me that I took while I was out taking pictures of the pink lady slippers, the pink moccasin flowers, and you will see that the mosquitoes were present, and that some had come and died, and others had just come and were dining, and so there's, you know, it's like I said in one of the comments, I think it was, you know, it's the price you pay. The mosquitoes are the price you pay for admission to the swamp. But really, the mosquitoes are the price you pay for admission to northern Minnesota this time of year. So get used to it. Just deal with them. As I said, in the swamps, there are some beautiful pink moccasin flowers. They're blooming, and they are just everywhere out there. I took a quick hike through my swamp, and I counted 24, and I wasn't even wandering. This is just on probably an acre or two of swamp. Actually, this would be, by definition, a black spruce swamp. It is. It has enough water moving through it that there are some nutrients there, and it grows a pretty good variety of trees, black spruce and tamarack. There's some tag alders down, or speckled alders down along the edges. So it's a pretty rich swamp, and in there I found, like I said, several pink moccasin flowers. I also noticed a lot of buckbean is up, and some is blooming. Three-leaved Solomon seal, another small plant that grows down, you know, 5, 6, 7 inches. The Solomon seal and the buckbean are similar in that the Solomon seal, both of them have a spike of flowers that comes up from several, well, in the case of the buckbean, it's like three of these big lobed leaves that are sort of like, I guess, roughly the equivalent of a clover, but much bigger, probably 3 inches long. Each of the leaves is probably close to 3 inches long and an inch or an inch and a quarter wide. The Solomon seal comes up out of a plant that looks a lot like, Canada Mayflower or Bluebead Lily. Got lily-like leaves, but there are three, and you can count them, you can see them, and then there's this spike of white flowers. Buckbean has bigger flowers with 5 petals, and Solomon seal has smaller flowers with 6 petals. So you've got buckbean, and you've got three-leaved false Solomon seal. You've got bog laurel, which is a beautiful pink flower, about 3/4 of an inch across. And if you are out in the bog and you're looking at the bog laurel, look to see if the anthers are still tucked into those little pockets. You probably remember I told you about how these work last week, where when the flower first opens up, the anthers are stuck in these little pockets on the petals of the flower. And when an insect lands on that flower, the energy of the insect landing jars loose these anthers, and they come out and slap the insect with their pollen. So check out the bog laurel. And besides bog laurel, let's see, Labrador tea began to bloom this week, and you can't miss Labrador tea. It's got these great clusters of white flowers at the top. And if you're in any doubt about Labrador tea, pick a leaf and turn it over. And if the bottom of the leaf is covered with a dense orange fuzz, a dense orange hairs, then you definitely are looking at Labrador tea. Cowslips, which were not blooming in this bog, but are blooming in other bogs or swamps or watery ditches, are getting toward the end of their blooming for the year, although there's always one or two that are found late in October that are blooming, just probably based on timing. I don't know why, but it seems like late October there's always a few cowslips that bloom. But for For now, we're about to see the last of them in this area. And spatterdock has begun to bloom. Now, spatterdock is that big yellow flower that you find in wetland. It would be water, you know, lakes and bogs or lakes and marshes and whatnot, where you have floating water and lily pads. And then you will find those bright yellow flowers that are spatterdock. The other thing that I'm seeing in the swamps right now are two types of cotton grass, and there are a dozen different names for cotton grasses, so it's really hard to pin them down, but according to the book that I was looking at, one is the rough cotton grass, and the other is the tussock cotton grass. And the difference really quickly is that the rough cotton grass has multiple heads of cotton at the top. So you look at these cotton grasses, and if you see just one fuzzy white gob of cotton at the top, you're looking at tussock cotton grass. If you see three, you're looking at rough cotton grass. But as I said, the names change. So wander back out of the swamps with me, and very quickly I'm going to run down some of the flowers that, and oddly enough, a lot of these flowers, I saw them in bud last week when we were talking, and may have talked about them. And as of yesterday, a lot of them were in bloom, including smooth rose. The roses have just begun to bloom. I saw my first ones yesterday. Canada milk vetch, starflower, blue bead lily, sarsaparilla, blue-eyed grass, one of my favorites, boy. And blue-eyed grass, there's a picture on the Facebook page of a single flower. But basically what I do, I drive along and I'm looking in the ditches, usually right near the road's edge, and I'll see these clumps of what look to be quack grass, just grass, you know, just these clumps of grass. But as I'm driving along, I'll see this big splash of blue color, and then I know I'm looking at the blue-eyed grass. And if you see that, should really stop and get out and look at those flowers closely, because they are absolutely gorgeous. They're deep blue, sapphire blue. Well, they're even deeper than a sapphire. They're just a pure deep blue. And then they have this gorgeous bright yellow center of the flower, which is lovely to look at. So blue-eyed grass is blooming. Tall buttercup is beginning to bloom in the ditches, and swamp buttercup is nearing its peak of bloom. And there, the obvious difference is where they're growing. The other obvious difference, if you look at both of them over a period of time, the swamp buttercup has a kind of a more yellow color to it. And I'm talking about the foliage, no, not the plant, but the foliage is more yellow-green than in the case of the tall buttercup. Sandcress is blooming. That's kind of an awkward one, little tiny plant, probably about, it grows up quite tall, maybe 12, 15 inches, but the flowers are very, very small white flowers at the top of these sandcress. Hawkweed began to bloom yesterday. Oxeye daisy began to bloom yesterday. I saw speedwell for the first time yesterday. White campion was blooming yesterday. And bunchberry are definitely starting to bloom pretty well. Two plants that are on their way out, besides the cowslips that we mentioned earlier, two woodland plants that have been blooming for a week or 10 days, or in the case of the wood anemone, probably for the last 3 weeks, are about to finish up. And on Sunday, there were patches of wood anemone at my place that were late to start blooming, but were just absolutely at their peak. I mean, those flowers were opened up. You could see each of those five sepals, bright white sepals, on those wood anemones. And I put them down as being at their last peak of bloom. And I suspect that the wood anemones will become just a distant memory here in the next week or so. And the other one, purple clematis. I was driving along, I was walking along in the woods by my house, and I happened to be looking at some strawberry plants, thinking, oh boy, it won't be long. We'll be setting berries here, and we'll be actually eating strawberries in another 3 weeks or so. And as I was looking at the strawberries, I noticed one petal from a purple clematis laying amongst the strawberry plants. And it reminded me that the purple clematis is one of those plants that comes and goes very quickly. Began to bloom probably 10 days ago or so, and now has completed its bloom and is on its way out. So if you haven't gotten out to see the purple clematis yet, today better be the day, because by the end of this week, you won't find many purple clematis at all anymore. So check them out. Trees, some notes about the trees. The red maples, of course, are absolutely freighted with, the female red maples are absolutely freighted with seeds right now, and the seeds are kind of a reddish brown. So if you're driving along and you see these trees that are just caked with a red brown color amongst all of the green of their leaves, you're probably looking at a red maple. Horse chestnut was blooming when we talked last week, and now the flowers have faded. The horse chestnuts are just about done blooming for the year. Mountain ash is at peak bloom right now. Mountain maple, a shrub that is sort of kind of grayish brown, almost a khaki color on the old growth and bright red branches on the new growth. And above that, or at the peak of the branch right now, you'll see these great long clusters of yellowish green flower buds. And the mountain maple will be blooming very soon. Red osier dogwood is blooming. This is a plant of the lowlands, usually pretty near water. If you find red osier dogwood, you're not far from water. And the red osier dogwoods are blooming. I was up at Scenic State Park a week ago, and I saw downy arrowwood in bloom. And the big tooth aspen. Yesterday and the day before, Sunday and yesterday, there was a lot of cotton floating around on the wind, and that more than likely was the big tooth aspen. They run a couple of weeks behind the trembling aspen, and the trembling aspen cotton was out around the 22nd, 23rd of the month. And here yesterday, June 6th, and the day before, June 5th, big tooth aspen cotton was floating around. There's an awful lot of things going on out there. I hope that you will take the time to get out, and please don't be afraid to put on a pair of rubber boots or just a pair of old tennis shoes and take a hike in the bogs. The reward is well worth the effort. That's the Phenology Show for today. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in again next week, and we'll do it all again. It's time for TalkBack. TalkBack is your opportunity to communicate with us. Maybe you've got an observation you'd like to share, a comment you'd like to make, or a question you'd like to ask. It doesn't matter. We always like hearing from you. And you can call us on our TalkBack line. That number is 999-9876. You can also reach us by email at comments@kaxe.org. And you can reach me personally by sending your emails to jlatimer@kaxe.org. That's JLATIMER. And you can always write us a letter. We certainly like to get your letters, and you can send those to 260 Northeast 2nd Street, Grand Rapids, Minnesota 55744. We did hear from some of you this past week, including our good friend Sam down in Nisswa. And Sam said, "Sorry I missed you last week, but I will include some old notes in the first part before this week's phenology. On the 28th, we found a few black morels. On the 29th, blueberries, lilacs, and bunch berries were blooming. On the 30th, the first monarch butterfly and some wild crickets were heard. On June 2nd, blue-eyed grass, waterleaf, leafy spurge, and lupins were blooming, and June 2nd was the last day of school. The third was very hot and muggy. Found a brown thrasher nest in the rhubarb with three speckled eggs." Wow, brown thrasher nest. That would be special. "A blue-lined skink The fourth was hot, and many mosquitoes, a few deer flies and dragonflies were out in masses. Jack and the pulpits are blooming, swallowtail butterfly. On the fifth, one brown thrasher egg hatched in the rhubarb. The goat's beard, yarrow, false Solomon seal, blue bead lily are all blooming. Found some things that we think might be bastard toad flax, also blooming. Among everything, almost everything is up in the garden. Strawberries are forming strawberries. That's a good thing. Baby robins are in their nest. And Sam heard a green frog calling yesterday. So lots of things going on down in Nisswa. Many of the same things happening right here in Grand Rapids. We did hear from Akeley this past week, and Emmeline was our caller.
I had a scarlet tanager yesterday morning, which was May 30th. Beautiful. I haven't seen one for years. This morning, sitting out having coffee, I had a cardinal at the bird feeder, which I haven't had for several years. And then about 2 weeks ago, we had these flocks of beautiful little warblers, and they looked just like a mini oriole. And I don't know if they are the Blackburnian warbler or the Cape May warbler, but they are absolutely beautiful little things. And they eat the grape jelly along with the orioles and have lots and lots of orioles. They eat about a quart of grape jelly a day. It's got so many. And hummingbirds, and of course lots of those yellow, little yellow finches, rose-breasted grosbeaks, and thrushes, and just all kinds of things this year that are just absolutely beautiful.
Thank you, Emmeline. Wow. I can't even imagine how many orioles or how piggy they would have to be to eat a quart of grape jelly a day. That's incredible. You must really have a flock of orioles around there. I'm not sure. You know, you talked about the warblers coming with the other birds to your grape jelly feed, and you wondered if they were Blackburnian or Cape May. I don't know. I've not heard of anyone talking about getting Blackburnian warblers down to a jelly feeder. Cape May warblers, I know, do come down to jelly feeders. Redstarts also look like little mini orioles, and I'm not sure that they would come down. I haven't had them come to the jelly at my house. Now, maybe somebody out there listening has a better idea, but I'm sort of leaning towards Cape May because in the past, I've talked to people who have had Cape May warblers come to their feeders, so perhaps that's what it is. And the scarlet tanager and the cardinal, boy, those are red-letter days. Beautiful birds. The tanager, of course, is bright red with black wings and a black tail. And the cardinal is, if it's a male, it's pretty much all red. Beautiful, wonderful experience. We heard from our good friend Joel, who sent some notes along from Park Lake and said the May weather for Park Lake in Carlton County averaged 47.4 degrees with a rainfall of 4.27 inches. May was slightly cooler and wetter than average. Our string of Goldilocks weather, no extremes, continues dating back to last spring. Today we reached 80 degrees for the first time since August 30th of last year. Continuing a tradition of some 25 years, my beard was unceremoniously shorn and will not make a return appearance until fall. Choke cherries began flowering today, and the lilacs are more than 50% in bloom by midday. The big mayfly hatch of several days ago is receding. Black flies faded away a few days ago, and today I saw and failed to dispatch my first deer fly of the season. Eastern tiger swallowtails, monarchs, bees, and hummingbirds are enjoying the lilacs and the flowering fruit trees. Mosquitoes have reached the moderately annoying level. We've got enough now that you needn't bother to send any my way. I wouldn't mind a bushel or two of dragonflies if you've got any to spare. Well, Joel, bad news about the dragonflies. Most of mine are too heavy to ship. I couldn't afford the postage on them because they're so full of mosquitoes that they're, a lot of them are just like walking on my driveway rather than flying around right now. And they seem to be getting all the food that they need here. And I guess you're just going to have to get your own dragonflies down there. And yeah, moderately annoying sort of covers it for the mosquitoes, I would have to say. They become annoying when you can walk out the door and just clap your hands together without, just randomly clap your hands. And if you look at your palms afterward and there are more than two or three dead mosquitoes, then the mosquitoes have reached the annoying level. We did have one more phone call this week. It came from our friend Kristen, who called from Big Fork.
We've got columbine blooming up at our neck of the woods. We've got an oriole who keeps popping in about once a week, and I, as soon as I see it, I wait till it goes, and I run out and put grape jelly and a little or half of an orange, and then it's usually gone for another week. So I'm still trying to coax them in, but probably the most exciting sighting for us has been just mass number of hummingbirds. We counted almost 20 at our feeder at once, and I have a little video that I did post on Facebook, and I'll put it on the KAXD page. It's usually in the evenings, and I'm just wondering how many we're going to have once we get the little adolescents coming in. But it's very exciting to watch. However, our deck has been rendered completely useless because otherwise we'd be dive bombed at all times. But it is incredible viewing. I've never seen anything quite like it, and it's very entertaining. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Kristen. You're not alone in marveling at the number of hummingbirds this year. I had a friend I talked to on the mail route, and Jerry said he's got so many hummingbirds at his house he can't keep up with the demand at his feeders. He said that, and I can't even believe this, but he said in some cases there would be two hummingbirds drinking from the same opening on the feeder. Two birds with their beaks in the same opening. And I thought, my God, I've got this little, I don't know, he's just this little adamant male, and he just buzzes everything that comes to my feeder. If it's not one of his, he's not going to let it feed there. So I don't get that many, but I still enjoy every one I get. That's our Talk Back show for today. Thanks for your contributions. We'll talk again next week.
Listening to Phenology Plus on KAXE, community radio for northern Minnesota, 91.7 on the Iron Range, Warba, Wirt, and Walker, 89.9 in the Brainerd area, 105.3 in Bemidji, audio streaming on the internet at KAXE.org. I'm Scott Hall with John Latimer. Coming up on Phenology Plus, a talk on the wild side with John and Harry Hutchins. Harry talks about his wild bike ride and the ups and downs of monarch butterfly populations. Also, Mark Johnson from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association and John Hart from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services, they'll be talking about a proposal by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to remove the timber wolf from the endangered species list. Phenology Plus is made possible by our listener members and by Atchison Tire Company in Grand Rapids. Locally owned for more than 90 years, Atchison Tire has offered new tires and repair services for generations of their customers. Online at atchisontire.com. We also have support from the Bonner Eye Clinic in Grand Rapids. At the Bonner Eye Clinic, Drs. Bonner, Mariano, and Kincannon have served the eye care needs of Grand Rapids, Itasca County, and the Iron Range for over 45 years. Located at 1542 Golf Course Road, the Bonner Eye Clinic is proud to support KAXE, authentic local radio. Chris Tolman from the Headwaters Science Center will lead a birdwatching class for youth starting next Monday, June 13th, and going through Friday the 17th. The class will meet from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. each day, and the class is geared for 3rd through 8th graders. It'll take place at the Science Center in Bemidji, with field trips to Lake Bemidji State Park and other outdoor sites. The class will cover binocular use, field guides, tips for bird identification, bird habitat, and how to start a life list. And there'll also be projects to attract birds to your backyard. For registration information, call KAXE. The Minnesota Women's Woodland Network is hosting a program on invasive tree and other plant species. That's this Thursday evening, 5:30 in Holyoke Township in Carlton County. You'll learn to identify those plants and how they affect the forest landscape. And again, call KAXE for more information. 218-326-1234. Time now for a talk on the wild side with Harry Hutchins and John Latimer. Harry is a forest ecologist, and he teaches in the forestry program at Itasca Community College. This week, Harry and John talk about changes in monarch butterfly populations, and Harry reviews the wild things on his recent bike ride.
While riding the bike trail, I think just a couple of things I didn't really notice, and I've ridden a couple sections now. The section, for example, from Mount Itasca up to Taconite and Highway 7 there. It's really interesting to see the differences because they haven't done much there as far as removing trees. And they removed a tremendous amount of trees in the last year from Grand Rapids to, say, the Prairie River Bridge. Because I bike that all the time for the last, I don't know, 12 years or so since it's been built. And then I really noticed that, just like with your phenology, I noticed the changes and the differences. And for example, you get to a big swamp, tag alder swamp, with willow tag alder, and just about a mile and a half maybe out of Grand Rapids from mm-hmm. the fairgrounds.
Yep, I know the one.
And there's always been alder flycatchers calling. Mm-hmm. And kind of little, fitz-pew! So they kind of greet me. Well, I've only been there once, but they weren't calling this time. And all the a good amount of the alder was dead. Now, I don't know why it died, but, you know, sometimes you see these changes. And, of course, the other things that I noticed, for example, so many of the trees have been removed. I didn't see the indigo bunting.
Ah, yes.
And the indigo buntings used to be on that trail, and the rose-breasted grosbeaks and things like that. On the other hand, it was so, and there's not much shade now.
Oh.
And biking yesterday was hot, especially on the way back when it was later in the day. But so there's a little service. Again, we talk about how much services are worth to us. That shade would have been worth a lot to me if it was still there. But the other thing, going from Mount Itasca to Taconite, oh, you want a nice trip. Get yourself up in the morning. Just take that little bike ride. It's flat at that part for the most part. And, man, with the orioles and the rose-breasted grosbeaks and the red starts and everything, we're just... It was, you like to use that C word. What is it? Cacophony or something?
All right, yeah.
It was,
or
it was
a cornucopia.
So,
I'm not sure. It's
I
one
just
of those
got
words.
My hearing aids tuned up again, and boy, going through there, it was loud and fun.
Wow, nice.
And the warbling vireos, and it was just, oh, what a mixture of great noise. So, anyways, get out on that bike trail, and maybe you will have the same fun that I did listening to all that noise, because it won't be long. It'll be
quiet again.
Quiet again.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, we've got basically the rest of this month, and then it's over.
Isn't that something?
It's so short.
It's the same thing with a lot of these plants.
Yeah.
And because of that, in a couple of days or a couple of weeks, we should probably be getting ready to celebrate the days turning shorter and winter heading.
No. Let's not go there yet.
Well, after yesterday, I was ready to go there, let me tell you.
Well, yeah, yesterday was one of those days.
So anyways, besides the aesthetics, I think it's important to realize some of those things that those trees do provide for us besides wood products, especially along that trail. I was getting a little bit disappointed. You know, there's been a couple articles. You're talking about the monarchs, right?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
the monarch butterflies had their worst year ever, the worst winter ever last year. Let's see, 09 and 2010, I should say. The ones that go down to Mexico that we're so familiar with about hearing about. And their populations hit an all-time low. Now, it rebounded a little bit this year, 2010, 2011. They saw a little bit higher numbers. But they're still shrinking into a smaller and smaller area because of the illegal harvesting that goes on in this reserve. And that's one of the big reasons. And I'll talk about the other two here in a minute. It'd be interesting to me to match some of the stuff that you and your listeners see up here with kind of matching up with what's going on in the wintering areas, some of these big wintering areas that we know about, especially the Mexico area. So anyways, start taking a look at your data. It'd be kind of interesting to see if you see declines and now you should see hopefully a little bit of an increase maybe this year.
Yeah, you know, I don't do a lot with populations. I just kind of note their arrival, and then if there are a significant number, I might note that I'm seeing a lot of something. But there are a lot more things that I could do to get a better handle on that. I know that one year, and I think it was 96 or 97, I can't remember exactly now, but one of those springs, it was August before I saw a monarch, and then I only saw, I saw two monarchs that year, and they were within a day of one another and within a mile of each other, and I think that they were maybe the same one. Mm. I don't know. But that was a really startling bad year for monarchs up here.
Okay, so what they were saying was, and this is some recent research that's just come out, is that they usually use only about an average of about 7 hectares, which is, you multiply that times 2.5. So what we're talking about is maybe 20-some acres. And they congregate in this just a small area. And that area had been reduced last year to down less than 1 or 2 hectares, and from 7 hectares as an average. And that's just because of, some of the legal cutting that goes on there. But here's the three big factors that they talk about: extensive illegal logging and overwintering forest, despite the creation of these monarch reserves. So that's one. The second thing is that the loss of breeding habitat in the U.S. due to expansion of genetically modified crops that resist herbicides, which led to the widespread loss of the milkweed plants on which the butterfly lays its eggs. So apparently the milkweeds are obviously not resistant because they're just plant out there. They haven't been genetically modified.
Right, they don't have that one little click in their genes that that allows them to resist the herbicides.
Yeah, so that's apparently having a big impact on monarchs up here. And then the third one is severe weather. Ranchers estimate that a cold 5-day rainstorm in 2009-2010, and that was the worst year for monarchs being able to survive down there, may have killed up to 50% of the overwintering monarchs.
Yeah.
So that gives you some kind of idea of, you know, if you're a monarch person and really interested in that and you wonder why you're not seeing some of them, that gives you a pretty good idea, I think, of some of the hypotheses out there that they're looking at that seem to be leading to the decline of this species?
Yeah, and I think locally, I think if you are interested in monarchs and monarch survival, I think one of the simplest things you can do is create your own little milkweed garden, and milkweed's pretty easy to grow.
Yeah.
All you got to do is go get some seeds this fall and put them in an envelope and mark them and leave them in your garage or someplace where they can experience what would be the equivalent of a cold winter.
Don't sneeze.
And then bring them out in the spring and rough up some soil a little bit and sow them in, and you don't have to worry about them. They'll find their way up above those grasses, so you don't have to, it doesn't have to be like a garden well tended, but you can grow a few milkweed plants and in the process maybe attract a few monarchs to your yard. That'll help.
A Talk on the Wild Side with John Latimer and Harry Hutchins. And if you have a comment, question, or topic you'd like Harry and John to address on A Talk on the Wild Side, send an email to comments@kaxe.org or call our talkback line 218-999-9876. Cutfoot Sioux Visitor Center in Deer River at the Chippewa National Forest hosts naturalist programs every Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday during the summer. Program highlights include building hummingbird feeders, bat houses and notebooks, Ojibwe language lessons, and capture the flag. Call KAXE for program information. And you're invited to be part of a bio blitz of Minnesota's newest state park on Lake Vermilion. On Saturday and Sunday, June 25th and 26th, join DNR biologists, naturalists, and other scientists to identify many of the plant and animal species in the park. There'll be lots of hiking and scientific inquiry during the 2 days. The event will take place rain or shine, so dress for the weather and call KEXE for more information. 218-326-1234. Last month, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service renewed its proposal to remove the eastern timber wolf from the endangered species list. There'll be a public meeting to discuss the reasons for delisting the wolf next Tuesday, June 14th, 7 p.m. at Davies Theater at Itasca Community College. Kathy Dodge and I spoke with the executive director of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, Mark Johnson, and John Hart, who works on controlling wolf predation on domestic animals for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Here's John Hart.
The gray wolf population in Minnesota has recovered basically beyond anyone's expectations, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for some years has known this. They've made a couple of prior attempts at delisting, and this will be another attempt, and they will be holding a public meeting in Grand Rapids on next Tuesday to discuss the delisting proposal.
The delisting is a national delisting, though.
The delisting proposal is sort of a national delisting and sort of reorganization of how they categorize wolves, but for our purposes here in what's called the Western Great Lakes states of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, it's basically about delisting wolves in those three states.
And what you mentioned, the healthy population of wolves in Minnesota, is that the main factor that they consider when they talk about taking a species off the list?
What the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has used as sort of criteria for delisting in Minnesota was that first, the Minnesota population had to be recovered. We're currently at 3,000 plus wolves in the population. Original recovery goals were 1,250 to 1,400 wolves in Minnesota, so that's been exceeded, actually over doubled. In addition to wolves recovering in Minnesota, there had to be a separate population in the Western Great Lakes region, and that turned out to be Michigan and Wisconsin. And that population had to be 500 wolves for five consecutive years. That criteria has been met. So biologically, there's really no reason not to delist wolves in Minnesota and Michigan and Wisconsin as well.
Why is Minnesota such a good place for wolves?
Well, Minnesota is kind of a special place because it was the last place in the lower 48 United States that that had a wolf population. Gray wolves were extirpated. That means there were none in none of the none of the rest of the lower 48 United States in the early 1970s when wolves were first protected. The wild and woolly border country and forest and lake and swamp country of northeastern Minnesota always held timber wolves. And in addition to being good wolf habitat, our long border with Canada, with Ontario and Manitoba, provided a constant influx of wolves from Canada. The population has done well and expanded basically to cover about half the state of Minnesota, and it's filled in and trickled over to the east and basically filled up the upper peninsula of Michigan and northern Wisconsin with wolves. And all those wolves got there naturally, basically immigration from Minnesota and from Canada.
Are they protected in Canada?
It varies from province to province. They're not protected federally. Different provinces treat them differently. Some they're a small game animal, some they're a fur bearer, and some they're a big game animal. But most of the provinces have some form of public harvest.
Of course, when the West was settled, the western states and ranching grew. There was a lot of poisoning and killing of wolves just to protect those livestock interests. And I suppose that was one of the main causes of the disappearance of the wolf, not in Minnesota, but to the West.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good historical perspective. Wolves were perceived both as a threat to agriculture and also as a competitor for wild game, which was a food source for, you know, a lot of people settling the country back then.
Mark Johnson, I remember years when the deer populations in Minnesota weren't so healthy and the whole wolf-deer issue was much bigger. What's the interest of the Deer Hunters Association in this issue now?
That's a really good question. The number one thing that we're interested in isn't the deer-wolf interaction. It's really that the wolf has been an endangered species, but it has recovered by far and beyond every benchmark set by the Endangered Species Act. And you know what that means, just like with a bald eagle, when they met their benchmarks or exceeded them, they were delisted. That's how the endangered species list works. That's what it was put in place for, is to help species recover. The wolf is one of those species that has far surpassed all those benchmarks, and it is time to have them delisted. Delisting means also that then management goes underneath the state, so that you do get a chance to manage them a little bit more in line with what are the tolerances of the state. In other words, how about, you know, in this case we're talking about, or we're worried about the depredations, wolves taking livestock, wolves taking pets, things like that. And John actually works for Wildlife Services with USDA that does those depredation services right now. If they're delisted or if they're not delisted, because of the population of wolves we have right now, we're always going to have depredations happening in Minnesota from wolves. So the question in our mind is, how do you number one, delist them, but secondly, whether they're delisted or not, how do you make sure that we have funding for those wildlife services that take care of the depredations, that help those ranchers, that help the, you know, keep the wolves just in check so that they aren't preying on the pets, they aren't preying on the livestock, and so on. They can be just a normal, good, wild animal.
So, John, over the years, you have been part of that wolf control program, and how did it work?
Sure. Basically, the USDA Wolf Depredation Control Program is authorized to assist agricultural producers and others that have had damage caused by wolves, and it used to just be primarily an agricultural situation. A beef producer or sheep producer in northern Minnesota, they're faced with lots of predators, coyotes, black bears, occasionally domestic dogs. But timber wolves were another one of those predators, and being federally protected, the producers had no legal recourse to deal with those animals that were killing their stock. And so the Federal Wolf Depredation Control Program basically has been in place for about 35 years, and it helps producers by verifying the damage. If wolf damage is verified, that is a wolf killed their calf or sheep, they're eligible for compensation by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And then they're eligible for assistance from our office. Sometimes that's non-lethal work where we work with a producer to just keep wolves off their property or to minimize the opportunity for losses. And then in some situations, it results in lethal removal of the wolves, where we actually do some trapping or shooting of the wolves that are committing those depredations on the farm.
So if wolves are delisted, what happens? What happens? You know, what can be done? I mean, what does the general population, how do they react?
You want me to take that, John?
Yeah.
Okay. That's a really good question, Kathy, because there's a real misnomer. A lot of people think that if they're delisted, protections are removed from the wolf, and that's absolutely not the case. Right now, they're federally protected, which means that the feds have the overall say on what happens with them. Once they're delisted, then they come underneath state management, and the state manages them under a management program that's approved by the federal government. It has to be approved by the feds. Otherwise, the state does not receive management, and they continue under management of the feds. Minnesota has an approved plan. It's been approved by the federal government. It was many years ago during this whole delisting process, which, you know, takes many, many years. So that they'd come underneath management of the state. They'd be managed as a game or non-game animal by the state. And so there'd be all the protections we have now. It's just coming by the state government instead of by the federal government.
When you have hearings like you're having tomorrow, are they ever get contentious? Do people show up and take sides?
Actually, it's next week. And the answer is
14th.
Yes. There's always the 14th. Mm-hmm. There's always people that have different sides at those meetings, and that's a good thing because mm-hmm. we want the Fish and Wildlife Service. Actually, it's the Fish and Wildlife Service who are hosting that meeting. It's an information meeting and a Q&A or question and answer meeting. They're not going to be taking public input per se. But they are, you know, they're going to be writing things down and taking this information, seeing what people think. And that's another thing we want to let the public know is it's time to get out and let them know what you think about wolf delisting, about how it's interacting with your life or your livestock or your pets or your concerns.
Speaking with Mark Johnson, he's the executive director of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. We're also joined by John Hart. John works in the Wildlife Services Division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and we're talking about the proposed delisting of the timber wolf here in Minnesota and at least in the upper Great Lakes states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. And tell us more about the Minnesota management plan. What are some of the details of that?
Basically, Scott, the Minnesota DNR Wolf Management Plan, primary goal is to allow continued maintenance of a healthy wolf population. They've set no maximum numbers. It's not like they're going to say we have 3,000 wolves, we're going to try to harvest them back to a certain point. Basically, they're going to manage wolves from a damage perspective, and they'll manage wolves that are causing damage. It's really not a big change initially from federal management. They'll maintain their status as a protected animal, like Mark said. There will be some provisions allowed for a livestock owner or a pet owner to protect their animals from wolves. Currently, if you're a livestock producer or if you're just out walking your dog and a wolf attacks it, you can't shoot or do anything to that wolf to protect your own property. Under state management, a person would be allowed to do that. But we've already had a couple of go-rounds with state management during two different periods totaling about 18 months in 2007 and 2008, and largely management wasn't very much different than it is now. Wolves were still protected. There were some provisions for people to protect their own property, and there was certainly ongoing wolf damage that needed to be addressed professionally, and that was, you know, our agency was involved under state management just as it has been under federal management in working with those producers who have had damage from wolves.
I got a question for all of you, including Dodger.
Uh-oh.
And I've wondered about this all the time. Well, actually, every especially large mammal like a bear or a deer or an elk or a moose and a wolf, they all have their special kind of mystique, I think, for humans. And just what do you think the mystique is for the wolf? It shows up in literature as kind of a scary critter, I think, a lot, don't you?
Yeah.
And bears, maybe sometimes. But just, Mark, what do you think is the mystique of the wolf in the human mind?
Everybody, I think, is somewhat impacted by those stories when they were kids, you know, the big bad wolf and so on. I think that has... by and large, gone to the wayside. At least I hope it has. In my mind, the wolf is a phenomenal and majestic I think, big game animal. It's a it's definitely a, you know, a large carnivore. It's got big teeth, and they eat things, and that's good because that's what they do. They and they should stay on our landscape. They have a place on our landscape, and they need to stay here. At the same time, I'm afraid that that mystique of it being a majestic animal, if they continue to be listed as an endangered species and inappropriately so in my mind, I'm afraid that mystique is going to lead them to become a, or that, that listing and the controversy is going to lead them to be considered a trash animal, a problem, and so on.
So it sounds like the Deer Hunters Association is supporting the delisting.
We definitely are supporting a delisting, yes.
John, any thoughts on what the wolf means to people?
You know, it means a lot to a lot of different people. I think one of the reasons why people are sort of so captivated with wolves in particular is because they're so much like us. They live in a family group. They're fairly social. They're the closest cousin to the so-called man's best friend, our pet dog. And so I think we have a lot in common. If you spend much time in the woods in northern Minnesota, you'll see that wolves travel around the country the same places we do. They use roads and trails, and they cover a lot of ground. And I think they're very similar to us, and so people have somewhat of a relationship with them in their mind as far as why they think they're maybe special.
Do you think they we think of them differently from bears or moose?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
As more accomplished predators or
I think so.
Ferocious
I think people
predators?
Still think they're more dangerous. You know, uh-huh. Bears are still considered, in a way, you know, you've got Yogi Bear and you've got Smokey Bear.
That's
you
kind
know,
of
you think of the big cuddly. And, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dodger, you have any thoughts on?
Well, I just, being an English teacher, I remember Willa Cather's My Antonia, mm-hmm. and in that there's a part where wolves are chasing people in a sleigh, and they overtake the sleigh, and it's very scary. And I just thought, well, you know, that doesn't seem really accurate. And I would miss the howling of wolves.
Oh, yeah.
I just think that, I mean, people, if they haven't heard that.
It's call of the wild.
That's
the
really
call
neat.
Of the wild.
Yeah.
That is something else.
Kathy Dodge and I spoke with Mark Johnson from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association and John Hart from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services about the recent proposal by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to remove the gray wolf from the endangered list in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is hosting a public meeting about delisting the wolf next Tuesday evening, June 14th at 7 p.m. in Davies Theater at Itasca Community College. For more information, call KAA. Finally, this week on Phenology Plus, as you may know, there's a heightened sense of urgency this year to do everything we can to prevent the spread of zebra mussels, water milfoil, and other plants and animals that do great harm to the natural habitat of our lakes. But hunter, angler, and outdoor writer Sean Parrish thinks the new boat inspection laws may have gone too far.
Like most lake-loving Minnesotans, I understand the introduction of invasive species may wreak havoc on our waters. Dense mats of Eurasian water milfoil choke out native vegetation and disrupt boating. Prolific zebra mussels may encrust nearly everything beneath the water's surface, from bottom substrate to boat docks and lifts. Native plants and animals suffer when invasives take hold. Luke Skinner, Invasive Species Program Supervisor for the Minnesota DNR, says zebra mussels and other aquatic invasives are appearing in lakes with heavy recreational use, such as Minnetonka and Mille Lacs, leading officials to believe they are primarily spread by recreational boaters. It is much less likely that invasives travel to new waters as stowaways on ducks or other aquatic critters. This is why efforts to control their spread are focused on boaters. It's important to note that no one believes this new law will stop invasive species or prevent new ones from entering our state. The hope is the law will slow down their movement from one lake to another. Day users, the primary target of current enforcement, are most likely to carry the larval stage of zebra mussels, which are free swimming in the water. By pulling your boat's drain plug, emptying the live well, and dumping the water out of your bait container, you're less likely to give them a free ride to a new home. One can agree this is a simple, common sense approach to curtailing their spread, but should not doing so constitute a crime? Skinner says that as an angler, he isn't thrilled about the new laws, but he says it may be the way we need to do things in order to control invasives. But perhaps the most troubling aspect of the new law is the boat ramp and roadside inspections, where everyone owning a boat is essentially treated like a suspect. After all, police no longer do roadside checkpoints to look for people driving under the influence. Conservation officers no longer have highway stops to look for game violators and must also knock first before entering an ice fishing shanty. Why, then, are we doing roadside checks to look at boats? Rod Smith, DNR enforcement spokesman, says the agency has consulted with the state attorney general's office and county attorneys to make sure the new checkpoints are legal. Instead of using licensed police officers to do the inspections, they've added a new certified inspector to look at boats. If they find a weed or a minnow bucket full of water, they can call a peace officer, likely a conservation officer or a sheriff's deputy, to write a violation ticket. As a boater, you do not have the right to refuse an inspection. The new law's authority is such that boaters have to submit to inspections in order to operate a boat on public waters. The inspection can occur when you are going to a lake or after you've left the water. Refuse, and you will be denied public access to a public resource. Also, while the boat inspection is ostensibly to look for compliance to the invasive species rule, the inspector may turn up other violations and contact a peace officer to take enforcement action. So now we have a situation in the state where anyone hauling a boat can be pulled over and inspected, and even if you are in compliance with the invasive species rule, you may wind up being ticketed or charged with an unrelated infraction. The bottom line is anytime you take your boat out to go fishing in Minnesota, you are agreeing to allow state inspectors and enforcement officers to go fishing too. The difference is you hope to catch fish. They hope to catch you.
Hunter, angler, and outdoor writer Sean Parrish. We hear his comments from time to time on Phenology Plus. And that's Phenology Plus for this week. We had production help from community radio station WTIP in Grand Marais. Our theme music is by Bella Fleck and the Flecktones and Weather Report. Phenology Plus is made possible by our listener members and by Dale's Auto Body in Grand Rapids. At Dale's Auto Body, customer satisfaction is based on 25 years of experience. The staff at Dale's is ready and willing to answer questions concerning the repair and estimating process. At Dale's Auto Body, repairs are vital to a vehicle's performance, safety, and resale value. We also have support from Itasca Surgical Clinic. At the Itasca Surgical Clinic, patients are provided with personal screening, diagnosis, and treatment of a full range of medical conditions, all in a caring environment. Thanks to the Itasca Surgical Clinic of Grand Rapids for supporting independent community radio, KAXE, and Phenology Plus. I'm Scott Hall with John Latimer. Thanks for listening.